it would admit, I was never so glad to see the Luftwaffe when a German pilot showed up to take them prisoner, as opposed to the alternative, who often wanted their heads. Using the Storks radio, Franz called Jaeger Field for a ride. Franz explored the downed B-17 as he waited for his lift. As Franz sat on the wing of the downed bomber, his thoughts raced to the bomber he had escorted out of Germany. He wondered if its crew were alive, kissing the tarmac and hugging one another in relief. Or were they floating in a raft in the North Sea, or on the bottom of the ocean in their four-motor tomb? Their fate mattered to him. He could not get the thought out of his mind. Was it worth it? At the same time, Seething Airfield. After a bathroom break and nap in the tower, Charlie asked Colonel Thompson for permission to visit the pub. Thompson agreed. He told Charlie he had notified Kim Bolton of the crew's predicament. The 379th was sending a B-17 in an hour or two to take them home. The sun was setting behind withered trees when Thompson drove Charlie west across the field to a hard stand where ground personnel had towed the bomber. Airmen milled around the plane, examining its damage with awe, some snapping pictures. Charlie and Thompson circled the bomber, marveling in the same way. In the soft, waning glow of the sun behind her, the pub looked defiant as she stood on her own legs. A mechanic walking the plane's wing drew Charlie and Thompson's attention to the number 3 engine. He had made a discovery. A 20-millimeter round had blown off the top of the fuel tank, but never ignited the fuel. At the tip of the right wing, Charlie looked up through the hole where the 88 shell had passed through, leaving a gap the size of a softball. Charlie and Thompson stopped at the tail section. Someone had draped a tarp across it to hide the sight of the deceased gunner's blood. Charlie told Thompson that his gunner, Ecky, had been looking forward to the base Christmas party that night. Circling farther, Charlie saw the stub of the horizontal stabilizer and shook his head. Looking up at the remaining half of the rudder, he saw that all but one of the rudder's control cables had been severed. "When I saw the condition of the airplane, it frightened me more than anything in the air did," Charlie would remember. "It seemed as if a hand had been holding us up in the air, and it wasn't mine." Their inspection completed, Thompson told Charlie he was going to recommend medals for the entire crew, including Charlie. He said he had one last question. "Why didn't you hit the Silk over Germany?"
"Sir, I had a man who was too injured to jump."
"So you and your crew stayed for just one man?"
"Yes, sir,"
Charlie said and nodded. To him it was that simple. They had fought for one another from a Texas bar to the skies of Bremen. They knew they were stronger together than apart. Thompson drove Charlie to Lieutenant Harper's office, a brick building south of the tower. There, Harper was set to debrief Charlie. Charlie and Thompson shook hands and parted alongside Thompson's jeep. Charlie had come to quickly admire Thompson, who was fatherly in his leadership style, compared to Preston, who was more like a big brother or a big man on campus. Some 3 months later, Colonel James Mackenzie Thompson led his group over Germany on April 1, 1944. Of the 21 planes dispatched, 5 did not return, including Thompson's. His B-24 hit heavy headwinds on the flight home and ran out of fuel over France. Only he and one other man from his crew bailed out. Thompson's parachute failed to open. Harper welcomed Charlie into his cozy office. The room's brick walls had been freshly painted white, and the windows had been covered with tan paper to block light from escaping. A pot-belly stove sat in the room's corner. From the ceiling hung small black airplane models that Harper said he used in teaching aircraft recognition to bomber and anti-aircraft gunners. Harper sat beneath his desk and motioned for Charlie to sit across from him. He opened a file and admitted that the interrogation would be his first, since his unit had yet to see battle. Charlie asked if Harper would be calling in the others, and Harper said there was no time because their ride was due shortly.
You can speak for your crew, he told Charlie. Charlie felt like a mess. His hair was stringy and his body felt sticky from sweat. A debriefing was the last thing he wanted. He also knew that now was the time to see his crew's bravery recognized. Like a testimony under oath, the story he gave Harper would become the official record. Harper unlocked a drawer in his desk and removed a bottle of Vat 69 whiskey and two shot glasses. He uncorked the bottle while explaining that policy permitted him to give each crewman a shot to loosen his tongue before reviewing a tough mission. He poured Charlie a glass. That morning, Charlie had turned down a drink from Walt, but now that moment seemed like another lifetime. Charlie slugged the whiskey in a stinging gulp. Harper kept holding the bottle at an angle. No one's counting here, he said. Charlie accepted another shot. Charlie walked Harper through the mission. He explained how Frenchy and Doc had downed enemy fighters, how Ecky and Blackie had remained at their useless guns to call out fighter attacks, how Peshaw had refused to leave his radio, and how Jennings and Andy had saved Russian from bleeding to death. Harper scribbled notes, hanging on every word. Charlie told him of the spin, of pulling out over Oldenburg, and of racing for the coast. Then the last 109 parked on our wingtip, Charlie said, and I thought it was all for nothing. Harper stopped Charlie. The last 109? Charlie clarified. Yeah, the one who flew with us. Charlie described their bizarre encounter with the German pilot who had escorted them out to sea and said goodbye with a salute. Harper cocked his head and stared at Charlie, as if he was joking. He flew with you? Harper said, leaning across his desk, incredulous. He was probably out of ammo, Charlie said, but he took us out of Germany. Harper slapped his desk. I thought I had heard it all, he said. Harper closed his notes. Charlie interrupted him to ask how he could nominate his crew for awards. He wanted a Distinguished Flying Cross, DFC, for each man, as well as a Bronze Star for Ecky. Harper told Charlie he might want to think bigger. They'll take one look at that plane of yours, and every one of you will be wearing the Bronze Star, Harper said. Charlie knew his request for DFCs for his crew was not asking much. The DFC was a modest medal given routinely to bomber pilots who flew 25 missions, or to fighter pilots after 50 missions. Harper promised Charlie he would forward his report to his counterpart at Kimbolton. It was around 5:30 p.m. when Harper walked Charlie to the base officers' club. Harper and Charlie found Pinky, Doc, and Andy sitting in plush chairs and eating sandwiches. A painted mural decorated the wall above a nearby fireplace. When Harper saw Charlie admiring it, he admitted he had painted it. The mural featured a creature with the body of a lion and the head and wings of an eagle jumping through the center of a massive blue American star. It was supposed to be a patriotic mural representing the bomb group on attack. Harper said painting was his hobby. Someday he hoped to be an artist. Doc and Andy covered their mouths with their arms and coughed, fighting not to break out in laughter. They found Harper's artistic rendition to be hilarious. Harper excused himself to call his superiors at 8th Air Force headquarters. He had told Charlie on their walk to the pub that he saw tremendous PR value in the story of a miracle plane and the crew that stayed together to stay in the war. He departed with a wave. Charlie told his officers about Harper's reaction. They grinned at the thought of how Harper would paint them as heroes. Charlie and his officers heard the B-17 land at 6:30 p.m., even before the orderly stuck his head into the club. The orderly informed them of a hitch. The B-17 had developed an engine problem and would need to be grounded for a while before its flight back to Kimbolton. The mechanics were working on it. Doc grumbled something about missing the dance. 3 hours and many cokes and sandwiches later, the orderly returned. The bomber was ready to fly again. As Charlie and his men donned their jackets, Harper entered the club with a wild look of concern. He was glad to have caught them before they left. Harper pulled Charlie to a nearby table and asked him to sit down. Charlie told his men to board the plane and that he'd catch up.
"I told them your story, just as you told me," Harper said. "But when I mentioned the part about the German, they went berserk."
Charlie sighed with relief. He thought Harper had come to deliver bad news about Russian. Harper explained that 8th Air Force Headquarters had given him orders to pass along. "When you see your crew, you are to instruct them not to discuss the mission with anyone." Charlie raised an eyebrow. "Here's the worst part," Harper said. "Forget about any medals for your crew."
"That's bullshit," Charlie said, standing.
Harper rose to Charlie's level.
"I tried as hard as I could. I know what headquarters is thinking. If your men get medals, people will ask how they got them. Then, if your men tell the story, they'll mention the Kraut pilot."
Charlie shook his head in disbelief.
"The brass wants you to forget this day ever happened," Harper said. "Those are the orders."
Three words crossed Charlie's mind. "Go to hell." But he held his tongue, tossed on his jacket, and started for the door. Harper caught Charlie by an arm and leaned in with a sudden whisper.
"Listen, suppose another of our planes gets in a similar fix, and suppose our gunners hold their fire just as a 109 swoops in because they heard some story about how he's going to fly with them. Now suppose this Kraut isn't as nice as yours and blows our boys out of the sky."
Charlie thrust his hands in his pockets. Harper had a point.
"What am I supposed to tell my men?"
Charlie asked.
"You tell them they did what they came here to do," Harper said. "Bomb Germany, fly home, and go back to do it again."
Charlie gave a terse nod. He and his crew weren't in it for the medals. Surviving a horrendous attack was just doing what they had volunteered to do. He looked straight at Harper.
"What about Ecky? Would you at least help me nominate my tail gunner for a commendation, for his family's sake?"
"Write it up, and I'll grease the wheels," Harper said.
In the dim light of a quarter moon, Charlie jogged toward the tower. His ride to Kim Bolton lay idling behind the tower. Peering across the field, Charlie looked for the pub, but couldn't see her. He passed the tower and approached his ride to Kim Bolton from the tail. Blue exhaust flames spit from beneath the bomber's engines. Charlie removed his crush cap and tucked it under his arm as he crossed through the prop wash. A crew chief waited with a flashlight near the bomber's rear door. For a moment, Charlie hesitated before he entered the plane. The crew chief had barely shut the door when the pilots gunned the engines, hurrying to make the 30-minute hop to Kim Bolton, 77 miles west. Charlie found Pinky, Doc, Andy, Frenchie, and Jennings in the radio room. Charlie apologized for not wanting to sit with them and explained that he was curious to see what England looked like at night, from the plane's nose. The pilots swung the bomber around onto the main runway as Charlie took his seat in the nose. The pilots gunned the throttles. The bomber barreled along the runway and had just lifted off when Charlie heard a popping sound from the left wing, followed by sputtering. The bomber had an engine problem again, this time a blown supercharger. The pilots lowered the plane back toward the earth and touched down. They slammed on the brakes and Charlie thought he heard an unusual squeal. The bomber veered left and ran off the concrete just before the end of the runway. As the bomber's wheels dug into the mud, the sudden stop threw Charlie forward into the plexiglass nose cone. Ammo cans, clipboards, and pencils from the navigator's desk cascaded around him. Lying with his head in the tip of the cone, Charlie trembled. The bomber, somehow, managed to stay on its gear.
As I sat there in the darkness, I reflected that it had been a very long and rather tiring day for a thoroughly frightened, confused, and totally misplaced West Virginia farm boy. Charlie would remember.
The pub would sit at Seething until March, when the men of the 2nd Strategic Air Depot would repair her over 23 days. The pub was then flown back to America and later scrapped.
Charlie followed the pilots out of the nose hatch and found his men behind the plane. The bomber had crashed just across the runway from the pub. The bomber's pilots examined the blown engine with flashlights. Frenchie looked at his luminescent watch. It was 9:47 p.m.
"I think we're going to miss the dance," he joked.
"I should have bailed out over Germany," Doc said. Charlie knew he still had to break the news to Doc and the others that their heroism was being swept under the rug. He was dreading the letter he had to write to Ecky's parents, and the question he knew they would ask him. How did he die? Looking at the wrecked bomber that should have been their ride home, and the pub sitting proudly, as if ready for another trip to Germany, Charlie said what each man in his crew was thinking. Why did I volunteer for this? 17. Pride. 2 days later, December 22, 1943, Kimbolton Airfield. Charlie slowly sulked up to the door of his Nissen hut, dragging his canvas kit bag. 48 hours after his traumatic flight over Germany, Charlie still wore his same heavy flying uniform. The 379th had sent a hapless truck driver to Seething to retrieve Charlie and his crew. The driver took all of December 21st just to reach them. He arrived at Seething wearing a ball cap too big for his head and said he had been lost because the English had taken down their road signs to confuse a German invasion. On the drive back to Kimbolton, he had crisscrossed the back roads of eastern England all night while Charlie and his crew bounced around in the rear of the truck. Only a flap of canvas separated them from the freezing cold. Following a 20-hour drive, they fell from the truck's lift gate at Kimbolton, sick from diesel exhaust. His eyes half shut, Charlie slowly opened the door to his hut. He had not bothered to check in at the squadron headquarters like Pinky and the others had. He only wanted to drop to his bunk to sleep. Charlie saw that fellow officers were straightening their ties and slicking back their hair for dinner dates. They stared at Charlie in the doorway, then ran to him, slapping him on the back. "Back from the grave!" someone yelled. Charlie grinned wearily. His good friend, Second Lieutenant Dale Killian, broke through the crowd, beaming a wide grin. Dale was a rookie pilot, too, and a simple farm kid from Iowa who resembled film star Ronald Reagan. Dale was 22 years old, so Charlie looked up to him, although Dale's gee-whiz mannerisms made him seem younger. "We were told you went missing over Germany," Dale said. Charlie told Dale and the others he had phoned from Seething. "Somebody didn't get the message," another pilot said. One by one, the men hurried to their footlockers and returned, piling Charlie's arms with his cologne, his comics, his socks, and his broken watch. Dale handed Charlie a stack of perfumed letters from Marjorie. "Glad I held off on burning these," he said. Charlie shook his head in disbelief. He knew the Air Force's standard practice was to remove the possessions of a downed crewman as soon as possible for morale purposes. They would always give the missing man's buddies the chance to sort through his belongings and remove anything embarrassing before the man's effects were sent home to his family. By tradition, the missing man's buddies were allowed to keep useful items, like books or toothpaste or hair pomade. Dale advised Charlie to hurry over to the operations office before they mailed the rest of his belongings home to West Virginia. Glancing toward the corner of the hut, Charlie saw a man sprawled out in the bunk Charlie had claimed. The man's feet were crossed, and his nose was in a book.
"What the hell?" Charlie muttered.
Charlie approached the man and stood at the foot of the bunk, his shadow blocking the man's light.
"I think you have the wrong bunk," Charlie said.
The man looked up from his book. Charlie knew the man was a replacement. The wings on his shirt revealed that he was a navigator. The navigator had already hung pin-up girls on the wall above his head and sat his shoes on the footlocker that had been Charlie's.
"They assigned this to me," he said flatly. "They wrongfully assigned it to you because they thought I was dead," Charlie explained.
"It was empty," the navigator said. "Just grab another one." The other officers in the hut looked up from their grooming.
Dale lingered silently a few paces behind Charlie. Charlie looked around. The hut was full. Charlie saw with relief that no one had disturbed Pinky's bunk, yet.
"That's not going to work," Charlie said.
"Then move to another hut," the navigator said. Charlie's face turned red. He had lived in that hut for 2 months and had grown used to his friend's snoring and nightmares. That cold, lousy hut was home. Charlie set his kit bag on the concrete floor and dumped his belongings from his arms into the bag. He thrust a hand into the bag, fished around, and pulled out his .45 pistol.
"You're going to leave one way or another," Charlie told the navigator.
"You're goddamn crazy," the navigator said, sitting up in bed.
"I'm going to fire one round through the ceiling," Charlie said. "The next round will be through your leg."
The man scowled, but did not move. Charlie leaned in close and whispered something inaudible. The navigator saw the pistol wobbling in Charlie's shaking hand. He got up, grabbed his shoes, and left the hut without his coat.
"I told him that I was combat certified, war weary, and could get away with it," Charlie would remember.
As Charlie's adrenaline dissipated, he sat down on Pinky's bunk. No one had raided Pinky's goods, because the replacement navigator had chosen Charlie's corner bunk instead. Dale called the other officers to help him gather the navigator's belongings. In a minute, they cleaned out the man's footlocker and departed, carrying his uniforms and effects in sloppy bundles to the squadron headquarters. Charlie flopped onto his cot and fell fast asleep. 2 nights later, Wiesbaden, Germany. The smoky pub was filled with pilots on Christmas Eve. The party was rowdy and coarse because the married men were away with their wives. Franz was in the center of it with Bobby. Normally, Franz liked to be in the middle of the party, but not the center of attention. With Bobby at his side, this was impossible. Willy was drunk and telling jokes, his knight's cross dangling proudly. When Franz had returned from Jever, he told Willy he had found the B-17 he downed in the farmer's field, but had no witnesses to confirm the victory. He never mentioned the bomber he let escape over the sea.
"You won't get anywhere by not claiming victories. I'll confirm it for you," Willy had said. "Your word is good enough."
Franz had never been closer to the Knight's Cross. But to him, the cross had taken on new meaning. He had seen the eyes of the wounded bomber crew, young men no different than the ones he had been killing for 2 years. He knew the cross stood for bravery, but Franz now realized it also represented a man's success at his most corrupted service to the world, his prowess at killing other men. Franz knew he could not stop fighting, the war would not let him, but never again would he celebrate his job as a fighter pilot, the role he had volunteered for. On December 20th, 1943, he had given up on the Knight's Cross for good.
"Don't bother," he had told Willy. "Let's go get drunk."
Because Christmas Eve was a special occasion, the pilots bought Bobby a beer. The bear loved the taste, so the men found him a bowl and filled it high with beer, then refilled it again and again, each pilot pouring the beer from his tall mug. The men got drunk with their mascot. Franz finally stopped his comrades from giving Bobby any more beer by insisting that they would need to help carry Bobby home if he became too inebriated to walk. The pilots sang obscene songs to one another, but changed their tunes when the local girls trickled in after midnight mass. At some point, they began singing Christmas carols, including a sad rendition of Silent Night, a German song by tradition. Franz would remember,
"At that time, religion wasn't the highest thing in Germany, but that did not stop us."
Franz stumbled out into the cobblestone street with Bobby. Drunkenly, man and mascot plodded to their apartment. With the voices of his comrades still singing in the background, Franz smiled, unaware that their time together was coming to an end. 11 days later, January 4th, 1944, Kim Bolton Airfield.
Charlie and his officers ate their lunches in silence in the nearly deserted mess hall. Dark circles sagged beneath their eyes. Instead of talking with one another, they looked around at other crews, at the swinging doors, at every sound outside the windows. They picked at their food and dropped their silverware, jittery. That morning, they had been assigned spare gunners and a temporary B-17 called Anita Marie. Soon after takeoff, they had lost an engine and returned to base. Now the group was away, bombing the German ports at Kiel without them. Charlie and his officers had just wanted to log another mission to put December 20th behind them. Charlie had broken the news to them about their heroics being quashed. The men couldn't care less. Russian and Peshaw had survived and were going home. Rumor had it that Blackie was coming back. What bothered them was that they had been stuck in limbo for 14 days. 3 times they had gone to bed expecting to fly the next day. 3 times they had tossed and turned all night, only to wake up beneath the orderly's flashlight beam and to hear his voice, "Sorry, sir, mission scrubbed." Now, instead of talking with one another, they talked to themselves and thought themselves in circles, pondering the odds against their survival. They imagined what they could do to improve their chances, like sitting on a flak vest, finding a new lucky charm, or going to the chapel more. They had become mentally rattled, or what the combat crews called flak-happy. Colonel Preston's policies had failed to help the quiet ones. Whenever Preston knew a crew had come back from a bad mission, he tried to put them back into the air as soon as possible. Preston had learned to do this from an earlier mistake. Several months prior, a crew had come back with wounded and dead men aboard. Preston gave them a week off at a rest home to calm their nerves. A 379th Navigator would remember what happened. They had used their week off to mull over their collective past and unpromising future. On their return, they announced their unanimous decision to quit the war. After that crew resigned from flying duty, Preston and the group's flight surgeon instituted a new policy to get a flak-happy crew back into the air and off the ground. But even Preston could not unscrub a mission or prevent an abort. Looking at his men, Charlie wondered if they were having nightmares like he had. Every night, he had been dreaming of the red flak orchids and of German pilots flying along his wingtips like devils. After December 20th, Charlie had come to conclude that his survival rested not in his hands, but in the hands of his enemy. Had the German flak gunner paid attention in gunnery school? Had he miscalculated the wind? Had the enemy fighter pilot been drinking the night before? Had his girlfriend visited him? To Charlie, this realization was devastating. Someone whistled a tune that echoed throughout the mess hall. The sound floated from behind the buffet, where cooks wore white aprons as they scrubbed pans. Charlie and his officers looked at one another. They all had heard the story of the cook, Snuffy, who was so happy to be in the mess hall that he whistled all the time. Snuffy had been a gunner once. The legend went that Snuffy was so certain his number was up that he had declared one day, "I ain't a-flyin' anymore," and tore off his sergeant stripes. He volunteered to work in the kitchen, and Colonel Preston allowed this. When Charlie dumped his tray in the trash, he looked across the buffet for Snuffy, but the whistling had stopped. Instead, all he saw were cooks who all looked the same, with healthy faces and rosy cheeks. Charlie did not want to ask which man was Snuffy, because he knew that to know Snuffy was to know defeat. Snuffy's whistling was a horrible siren, a lure to an airman to quit flying and follow him. Snuffy's only promise was the guarantee of life. One day later, January 5th, 1944, around 5:15 a.m. Charlie's breath fogged up the mirror as he tried to shave in the freezing cold latrine. He wore a T-shirt and a towel around his waist. Down a hallway behind him, showers poured hot steam that swirled against the door's cold draft. Every time Charlie splashed the sink's freezing water against his cheeks, he grimaced. He hated shaving, but knew it was necessary to ensure a good seal of his oxygen mask against his face. Charlie saw his likeness in the mirror. His face was pale, and his eyes hung sad. He could not smile. 16 days after December 20th, he knew he had to get back over Germany, or throw in the towel. Dale greeted Charlie as he stepped up to a sink a few mirrors over. Charlie grunted a greeting between swipes of the razor. Dale seemed alert, as if he had been up for hours. Charlie marveled at his happy-go-lucky attitude.
"Shoot!"
Dale said, pulling his razor away. Charlie glanced over and saw a crimson splotch through the shaving cream on Dale's cheek. When Dale placed the razor back to his face, Charlie saw his hand trembling. Dale nicked himself again. He looked over at Charlie with just his eyes, without turning his head. Charlie looked away. Dale was to fly his fourth mission that day, and the prevailing rumor was that an airman stood a 25% chance of completing his tour. By those odds, after Mission 5, every flight was on borrowed time. Charlie wanted to shout to Dale, "Why are we doing this to ourselves?" But he said nothing. There was no way that you could express that you made a mistake in volunteering, Charlie would remember. There was nobody that I could talk to. I couldn't tell my co-pilot, any of my crew, or even the other pilots. I could not do anything that indicated any weakness. Charlie knew that no pilot wanted to fly tight formation with someone rattled, shaky, or flak-happy. The third time Dale nicked himself, Charlie could not take it anymore, and departed, pretending he'd never noticed. Inside the officer's mess, amid the smells of fried spam and coffee, Charlie followed Dale through the chow line. Scrawled across the back of Dale's jacket was the name of his plane, Rikki Tikki Tavi 2, in jungle leaf letters. Below the letters, someone had painted a likeness of the smiling black mongoose, Rikki Tikki Tavi, a character from Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. In the book, Rikki Tikki Tavi defends a British family from two poisonous cobras, at great risk and suffering to himself. Alongside the mongoose on Dale's jacket, someone had painted three yellow bombs that signified Dale's completed missions, his commitment to his tour. The back of Charlie's jacket, like those of his remaining crew, was blank. A cook behind the chow line, maybe Snuffy himself, ladled eggs onto Charlie's plate. The man grinned politely. Before a mission, the ground personnel restrained their smiles, projecting quiet respect, until the flyboys were in the air. They never whistled or joked or said, "Go get 'em." Most of the cooks could imagine where the airmen were headed, a place Snuffy knew too well.
"Why did I volunteer for this?"
Charlie thought, as he looked from the cook in his dirty apron to the scared pilot ahead of him, his face nicked up, and the mongoose Rikki Tikki Tavi beckoning, "Follow me." The B-17s taxied one behind the other through the ground fog, the lights in the bomber's wings glowing like lanterns on a ship's bow. Every time a bomber launched down the main runway, the others rolled forward a plane length, then stopped. Far back in the snaking line, Charlie and Pinky sat behind the controls of another borrowed B-17, this one named Duffy's Tavern. Charlie steered the bomber, while Pinky leaned outside his window and shouted corrections to him so Charlie could keep the plane on the narrow taxiway. Charlie squinted at the two small white tail lights of the bomber ahead, trying to maintain a safe distance while trusting the pilot behind him to do the same. It was 7:45 a.m., but a sinister dark fog had turned morning at Kimbolton Air Base into night. The chilly fog floated in through Pinky's window. A few degrees colder, and it would have snowed. The runway lights passed by like tiny lighthouses on a foggy coastline. Bombers named Lakanuki, Deacons, Sinners, and Polly launched one after another toward the northwest, their red and green wingtip lights streaking through the fog.
"This is idiotic," Pinky said as he watched.
Instead of agreeing, Charlie gripped the yoke more tightly, his eyes darting with intensity. He was certain that nothing would stop them from logging this mission, another to Kiel, Germany. Soon, just a few planes sat between Charlie's bomber and the right-hand turn onto the runway. Through Pinky's side window, Charlie saw a bomber launch and disappear into the fog at the runway's halfway point. Suddenly, a yellow flash cut through the fog, followed by the sound of a thunderclap.
"Oh, shit!"
Pinky said as he recoiled. Charlie stomped on the plane's brakes. Flashes blinked from the end of the runway, each followed by an explosion like two fog-bound ships trading broadside cannon bursts.
"Dear Lord," Charlie said.
He knew that one of their planes had just crashed on takeoff. The bomber ahead of them sat still. The radio was silent. Pinky said half-heartedly that the mission would be scrubbed now. Then the shortwave radio squawked with a call from the tower and a terse message. "Continue takeoff sequence." Pinky looked at Charlie with alarm.
"What about the wreckage?" he asked.
Charlie just shook his head, his fists trembling on the controls. The bomber ahead of them moved up a spot, and Charlie knew another plane had launched. Charlie released the brakes and let his bomber crawl a few steps. He and Pinky could see the orange glow of the wreckage, but had no sense of depth or distance. Two planes ahead of Charlie, Rikki Tikki Tavi 2, turned onto the runway with Dale at the controls. The bomber revved its engines, sucking the fog around its body and blowing gray wisps from its tail. The lights of the bomber behind it lit Rikki Tikki Tavi 2's tail as it rolled forward and launched, vanishing like the others into the fog. After the bomber ahead of them had begun its takeoff roll, Charlie revved the engines on the left wing and began swinging his plane onto the runway. It was his turn, finally. He leaned forward, trying to see the white marks of the runway's centerline. An explosion, a bigger one, erupted in the sky ahead. Its orange tentacles of fire curled among the clouds.
"Holy shit!"
Pinky yelled.
"That has to be another one of ours," Charlie said,
his eyes fixed on the orange glow as it fell through the clouds to Earth.
"There goes another mid-air collision," someone said calmly over the radio.
A heavy thump, thump, thump drew Charlie's attention forward. His eyes widened as his bomber rolled off the runway and onto the grass. Distracted, he had forgotten to complete the turn. He stomped on the brakes and cursed. Gunning the engine, Charlie tried to swing the bomber back onto the concrete, but it had dug into the soggy ground and would not budge. Charlie ripped off his headphones and slapped them against the instrument panel. His cursing increased when he felt his bomber shake as the planes behind him took off, leaving him and his crew behind. Pinky leaned back in his seat and held his face in his hands. He looked like he wanted to cry.
"Is everything okay up there?"
a crewman's shaky voice asked over the intercom. Charlie slumped over the control yoke in disbelief. Pinky turned to Charlie and asked if he should call for the aircraft's evacuation.
"No. We're flying this goddamn mission,"
Charlie shouted, his eyes turning wild. He pushed the throttles full forward. The bomber's wheels trembled, but would not budge. When Charlie pulled back on the throttles, the plane seemed to rock back on its heels. Revving the engines again, Charlie cursed like a madman. Pinky shouted, imploring him to stop, telling Charlie the bomber would never move with a full bomb load. The bomber shook from the engine's fury. Its wheels vibrated, wanting to break free of the mud. Pinky reached and pulled the throttles back, shouting,
"Let's wait for the ground crew!"
Charlie shoved Pinky's hand away and pushed the throttles forward. The bomber trembled, then broke free. Its tires rolled up and over the troughs in the mud, then onto the concrete runway. Charlie pulled the throttles back to align the bomber's nose with the centerline, then rammed the throttles forward again. The bomber roared down the runway and leapt into the skies, soaring over the first burning bomber that had crashed in the field beyond the runway, and over the two others that had collided barely 3 miles from the runway. Charlie flew the bomber blindly up through the clouds, looking for the group.
10 minutes later, Charlie flew in the clear, above the clouds. He was still over England when Doc told him over the intercom that they stood no chance of catching up with the formation. "We either turn back or go to Germany alone," Doc said. Charlie scowled as he stared ahead, as if he could see Germany. Pinky turned to Charlie with fear in his eyes and said, "For God's sake, don't." Charlie's scowl softened and dropped into a look of defeat as he banked the control yoke left and turned back for Kimbolton. He flew tight-lipped, without asking Doc for a heading. Charlie knew the fires on the ground would guide him home. That same morning, an hour later. In the quiet warmth of the officers' club, Charlie sat at a square cocktail party and sipped from a glass of scotch. Two shot glasses sat before him, empty. On a sign above the club's door, red letters spelled Duffy's Tavern, the club's nickname. The B-17 Charlie had flown that day had been named in the club's honor. A few officers sat around the bar and drank Bloody Marys beneath a red and white striped awning that gave the bar a poolside flair. Someone had painted a beautiful blonde in a white bathing suit on the bar, and another reclining, with her back turned over the club's entrance. Charlie glanced at his watch with glassy eyes, following the group's progress in his mind. He knew they were approaching the German coast. When anyone entered the club, Charlie looked up at them with guilt. With two aborts in a row on his record, he knew he had become what the pilots called an outcast, a pariah. The real reasons behind the aborts, a bad engine and getting mired in the mud, didn't matter. What mattered was that he had done it twice. Every pilot knew that one abort was common because B-17s were complex machines that often broke. But two aborts in a row was a pattern that would give rise to suspicions of cowardice. The officers ignored Charlie. Instead, they ordered coffee and sat down around him to read newspapers. With the group gone, word of Charlie's abort had not yet traveled back, so the officers did not yet know that they had a pariah in their midst. Charlie was not the only pariah in Duffy's Tavern. The club's manager was a major who had been a pilot in the group until he covered his eyes during a German fighter attack. Preston had grounded the major, but allowed him to run the officers' club. Ashamed for letting the group down, the major now managed the club with vigor, turning it into a contender for the best-stocked bar in England. The other pilots had come to respect the major once again, because they no longer had to fly with him. Between drinks, Charlie reached inside of his brown jacket and unfolded a letter from Marjorie. Since December 20th, he had fast become a drinker, and justified it, telling himself it was medication for his nerves. For combat people, self-medicating is a big part of their reason for drinking. Charlie would remember. I only had two men on my crew who were not heavy drinkers, and both men ended up with psychological problems. Charlie had carried Marjorie's letter with him that morning as a good luck charm. Now he read the letter with cold eyes. As a joke, Marjorie had written that she wanted to apply to be his co-pilot. She also made Charlie grit his teeth when she asked, "Is it as bad as you thought it would be?" Charlie wanted to tell her so much. He wanted to tell her about watching Dale Killian's hand shaking as he shaved that morning. He wanted to tell her about how Ecky's chubby little boots pointed up from the stretcher. He wanted to tell her that he had just watched 30 young men die an hour prior. Their lives ended in a series of flashes. They were young men who had spent 20 or 22 years on Earth, growing and learning and living, just to die fewer than 3 lousy miles from their base, planted into an English field. Charlie crumpled Marjorie's letter. He wanted to ask her, "Would you have wanted to be the co-pilot on any of those planes?" Charlie was angry at Marjorie, only because he was angry with himself. He had realized that morning that his fate rested not in the hands of his enemy. The enemy had not killed the 30 men that morning. The odds had killed them. Charlie had decided that the odds were going to get him too, if he kept flying.
Shuffling toward his barracks, Charlie passed the squadron operations hut. He knew all he had to do was walk into the hut, fill out a form, and his flying days could be over. The clerk who worked there had once been a waist gunner. Rather than resign from combat duties, the man had taken his gloves off at high altitude and held his hands out in the slipstream until his fingers were severely frostbitten. Charlie knew he didn't have to freeze his fingers to achieve the same result. He could do it with the swipe of a pen. He knew shame. He had grown up a poor farm kid, unable to afford a comic book at the local drugstore. He could live with it. Then, Charlie saw him. A man was walking toward Charlie's hut with a brown box between his arms. Charlie knew the man, the orderly who gutted men's footlockers when they went missing. The man opened the hut's door and slipped inside. Charlie's eyes bulged with alarm. He ran across the field after him. Charlie entered the hut and found the orderly walking from bunk to bunk, looking for someone's footlocker.
"Can I help you?"
Charlie asked defensively.
"No, sir. I don't mean to be a bother,"
the orderly said as he opened a footlocker, sorted through some papers, and shut it. Charlie folded his arms. Turning to Charlie, he asked,
"Sir, maybe you can help me. Do you know which locker is Lieutenant Killian's?"
Charlie's face turned white. He dropped his arms.
"Why?"
Charlie asked.
"Lieutenant Dale Killian and his crew were killed this morning," the orderly said, shaking his head. "The midair."
Charlie sat heavily on the edge of a nearby cot as the orderly gave him the details. Dale's plane had collided with a B-17 from the 303rd Bomb Group. Charlie knew the 303rd was based just 6 miles to the northwest, at Molesworth. The flash he had seen in the clouds had been Dale's death. The official accident report would declare that no one was responsible because it is impossible to avoid such accidents with so many aircraft in the same vicinity. Seeing Charlie's face twist with emotion, the orderly apologized for bearing such news. Without a word, Charlie pointed to the bunk opposite his. The orderly knelt and opened the footlocker. He told Charlie he had to empty the lieutenant's locker of his belongings.
"It's a shitty job, sir," he said, "and I've got 9 more to go."
Charlie nodded, afraid to speak for fear of breaking down. The orderly gave Charlie permission to sort through Lieutenant Killian's belongings first, if he wished. Charlie thanked him. He knelt and sifted through the box as the orderly stood back. Charlie held Dale's Guide to Understanding England book and Dale's postcards of California, where he said he planned to live after the war. Stuck to the lid of the box with tape, Charlie saw photos of Dale with his farm family and a photo of him standing proudly in front of his B-17, his hands on his hips. Charlie's frown lifted slightly as the thought struck him. He and Dale had gone from being farmhands to captains of B-17s. Charlie suddenly remembered the pride of flying a B-17. He remembered how the gunners waved when he formed up on another bomber's wing. He remembered seeing white American stars on the flanks of bombers that stacked up to the heavens. He remembered looking across the frozen gap between cockpits and seeing a pilot like Dale or Walt look back at him and nod. The other pilots were just as scared to die as he was, but up there, Charlie knew they had mastered their fears by keeping the formation tight and sticking together. After 2 weeks away from the formation, Charlie had forgotten his pride. Looking at Dale's photos, he remembered why he would not back out of the brotherhood he had volunteered for. Charlie stepped from the footlocker and backed toward his bunk. The orderly scooped up Dale's belongings into his cardboard box, nodded to Charlie, and departed, the box between his arms. Charlie sat on his bunk in the empty barracks and looked across the aisle to where Dale's footlocker sat empty. He suddenly knew what he had to do. That same night, Charlie opened his footlocker and removed his leather jacket.
With the jacket folded over his arm, he entered the enlisted gunner's hut. The gunners stood to salute, but Charlie told them to relax. Charlie approached a group of gunners huddled in the hut's center around one man who was striking something with a clanging noise. When they saw Charlie, the gunners stood and backed away. The man at the center turned and looked up at Charlie with a grin. Charlie could not help but smile when he saw that the rumors were true. Sam Blackford had returned. Charlie squatted next to Blackie and discovered he had laid a small sheet of metal on the floor over which he had piled wood shavings and sticks. Blackie held a flint clip in one hand and a square of steel in the other. With a smirk, he explained that he was giving a Boy Scout lesson to his buddies. "Back home, they call me Sourdough Sam on the trail," he said proudly. Charlie told Blackie he was not a bit surprised. Blackie noticed that Charlie carried his jacket.
"Do you still want to paint your jacket?"
Charlie asked Blackie. Blackie nodded, his grin growing.
"Will you paint mine, too?"
Charlie asked.
"Sure," Blackie said. "What do you want on there?"
"Two bombs," Charlie said. "One for each mission, and leave room for more."
"How about I paint all the guys' jackets?" Blackie asked.
"Good idea,"
Charlie told him.
"Paint 'em up."
On his way out the door, Charlie stopped, having forgotten something.
"Blackie, can you paint the word Brayman on the bombs?" he asked. "When we get home," Charlie said, "we'll want to tell everyone where we've been."
2 days later, January 7th, 1944. In the dimness of the hut, Charlie dropped Marjorie's letter into his footlocker and shut the locker's lid. He had decided to write to her only after he had completed his tour, when he had something worth saying. Charlie would write to Marjorie months later. When he did write, his letter would come back undeliverable. On the airfield, a truck pulled up alongside the B-17, the Celestial Siren. Charlie and his crew, Pinky, Doc, Andy, Frenchie, Jennings, and Blackie, jumped from the lift gate along with three replacement crew members named Little, Miller, and Page. War paint covered all of their jackets. Blackie had painted the squadron patch, a skull and crossed bombs, on the front breast of some, and the quiet ones across the upper backs of others. On the jackets of the men who had flown on December 20th, he had painted two swastikas, one for each fighter that the crew had shot down, and a bomb with the word Brayman written across it. On each man's jacket read the words 379th Bomb Group. Charlie looked at his watch and declared,
"All right, let's get on with it."
The gunners sauntered around the plane to enter from the rear door. Charlie waited while Doc, Andy, and Pinky swung up through the hatch beneath the nose. The tired old crew chief, Shaq, and his ground crew stood watching. Charlie tossed his kit bag through the hatch. He reached up and, with an underhand grip, seized the bar that ran across the hatch. In one smooth motion, he curled his legs and swung up and into the bomber. His hand reached back down and slammed the hatch shut. That day, Charlie flew the quiet ones to Ludwigshafen, Germany, and safely back. In the days that followed, the quiet ones would be issued a bomber of their own, a B-17G named Carol Dawn. They would fly their next 26 missions together. They would survive a mission to Brunswick when the bombers on their right and left wings would be shot from the sky, and the ride home from Berlin when they would lose two engines simultaneously over the sea. They would return from Frankfurt when a massive headwind slowed them to a crawl over a flak zone. During those moments of terror, Charlie would have flashbacks and glance at the bomber's right wingtip, expecting to see the German pilot there, flying with him. On April 11, 1944, Charlie and his original crew would complete their 28th and final mission after an 11-hour flight to Zorau, Germany. Beneath their bomber's nose, Charlie would smoke a cigar and drink from a bottle of whiskey that he would pass between Pinky, Doc, Andy, Frenchie, and Blackie.
Even Jennings would break his rule and take a sip. They had survived their tour and more. By the war's end, they and other young men like them would have helped the 379th earn the title the Grand Slam Group for flying more missions, dropping more bombs, achieving higher bombing accuracy, and suffering fewer losses than any other group in the 8th Air Force. By war's end, the 379th would be the best in the bombing business. On that day, when Charlie would watch his men toast their survival, in the back of his mind, he would wonder about the German pilot who had escorted them out of hell. Who was he? And why did he let us go? Charlie would look to the eastern horizon and secretly hope that his enemy would survive the war. 18. Stick close to me. That same winter, March 19, 1944, Southern Austria. Light flurries fell from the gray clouds across the grass airfield as Franz knelt on the wing of the 109. Behind him, the wind blew across the city of Graz from the snowy blue mountains to the north. It was 1 o'clock p.m., but the winter weather made the day feel later. Franz leaned in close to the rookie pilot who sat strapped into the plane, his face long, pale, and harmless.
"We hit hard, hit first, then get the hell out of there,"
Franz told the pilot, a young corporal named Heinz Mellmann. Mellmann nodded rapidly with fear. Today would be his first combat mission. Mellmann looked like a teenager compared to Franz, now 29 years old. Franz's face had grown leaner, his jaw stronger, and his nose sharper. Flying 300 combat missions had turned him into a grown man. Franz and the rookie wore the new flight uniform, all gray leather with a black velvet collar. The rookie wore the other new fashion, a forage cap, a boxy ball cap with a long brim that kept falling snow from one's eyes. Franz didn't like the forage caps, and instead kept his gray officer's crush cap that was crumpled and worn in spots. Franz gazed south across the airfield and saw three squadrons, some 36 fighters, scattered about. Graz Airfield was an earthen strip set almost within the city's southern limits. On some days, the grass runway wore a blanket of snow. On either side of Franz and Mellmann sat 10 other pilots in their 109s, each waiting for a flare to arc across the field and tell them to start their engines, the sign that the four motors were near. The ground crewmen in their dirty black coveralls kept their distance, out of respect for the aviators. 2 months earlier, Ruddle had taken Franz from Bobby, Willy, and his comrades in Squadron 6 and shipped him to Yugoslavia. Ruddle had promoted Franz and made him the leader of JG-27's Squadron 12. 11 pilots came under Franz's care. Bobby had to remain with Squadron 6 because he was their mascot, but before Franz and Willy parted, Willy had promised Franz, "Don't worry, I'll look after the bear." Just 3 days prior, Franz had led Squadron 12 to its new home at Graz. At Graz, new faces appeared, rookie replacement pilots. Within the batch of rookies were Mellmann and another youngster, Sergeant Gerhard Sonntag, both assigned to Franz. Both of the young men were in their early 20s, but neither had flown combat yet. That day, Franz had scheduled them to fly as his wingmen on their first mission. He knew if they survived a week's worth of missions, they might just make it as pilots. Franz thrust a hand into his thigh pocket and scooped out a handful of roasted coffee beans. He chewed a few, savoring the caffeine kick. Franz offered some to Mellmann, who declined. The days were gone when replacements were veterans of Spain or the Channel Front. What veterans the Air Force still had left were scattered at all ends of the continent, dropping one by one, leaving rookies like Mellmann to take their place.
"I really worried about these kids, and along with the most responsible squadron commanders, tried to bring them along slowly, but the war would not always wait,"
Franz would remember.
"I can remember that terrible feeling I got when I was forced to have them fly combat before they were anywhere near ready, for I well recall how green I was during my first combat, and I had several thousand hours of flying time.
When Franz looked at Melman, he knew he was looking at Germany's great tragedy, a generation of innocents too young to have seen the rise of Hitler or the party, who now were forced to pay for their leader's sins. Franz looked to the tower, but still saw no flares. He knew the bombers were on the way. The early reports said 300 American heavies had departed Italy and were heading north. At that moment, German Air Force spotter girls were sitting in the mountains of Italy and Yugoslavia, tracking the bombers with binoculars and calling in their progress to JG-27. The lower half of Italy had become the Allies' newest base after their conquest of Sicily. Everyone knew the invasion of France would come next, giving the Allies new airfields, even closer ones.
"If you're hit, bail out away from the bombers,"
Franz reminded Melman.
"Float through a bomber formation, and the gunners will shoot you."
The rookie nodded, gulping. Seeing the ill effect of his warning so close to takeoff, Franz slapped the rookie on his back and assured him,
"Stick close to me, and you'll come home alive."
Melman managed a smile. Franz never was cocky before, but now he exuded a forced confidence to bolster the spirits of the younger guys. Franz slid from the wing and walked to the fighter of his other rookie, Zontak, to give him the same talk. Franz stopped and shouted back to Melman,
"If you're going to get sick, do it now, outside your plane."
The ground crewman thanked Franz with a chuckle. After talking with Zontak, Franz settled into his fighter. He still flew his old yellow II, only now the plane's rudder was painted white, the mark of a squadron leader. Franz's plane no longer wore the Berlin Bear crest on the nose. Instead, an Edelweiss flower had been painted in its place, the badge of his new parent unit, 4th Group. Sealing the canopy, Franz relaxed within the familiar aroma of oil, gunpowder, and sweat-drenched leather. Franz rapidly cycled his black rosary beads through his fingers. The black paint had begun to fleck from the beads, revealing their true color, a pale purple. His prayers had changed lately. He now prayed that he would lead others well. He no longer prayed for himself or for his safety. He had long given up on the idea of surviving the war. Franz had been away from Squadron 6 for only 2 weeks when a sergeant came looking for him on his base in Yugoslavia. The sergeant nervously told Franz that the wing commander, Ruddle, was on the phone in the tower, waiting to talk with him. The sergeant thought Franz was in trouble, not knowing that Franz and Ruddle were protege and mentor. The date was January 29th, and Ruddle was calling from his headquarters near Vienna. He sounded disturbed. The day's casualty report, a teletype, had come across his desk. Willy was dead. Willy had led his squadron against 800 bombers that had bombed Frankfurt. The bombers' P-38 escorts had chased Willy down to earth, where the clouds were low and foggy. Disoriented, Willy had flown into the ground. Franz could not believe it. Willy was gone, at 22 years old, planted into the earth 50 miles west of Wiesbaden, near the town of Wurich. All Ruddle could say was that he was sorry. Franz heard defeat in Ruddle's voice. When he hung up, Franz buried his face in his hands. For a few days he beat himself up over the thought that he could have saved Willy, because they had once handled a dozen P-38s, just the two of them. A red flare shot across the field. Dropping his rosary into his chest pocket, Franz signaled his ground crewman to crank over the engine. Franz and his pilots ignited their fighters' snarling V-12s. The spinners of planes belonging to their sister squadrons, Squadrons 10 and 11, also spun to life around the fields. Franz looked to his left and right to confirm that all his pilots' engines were humming. White smoke belched from their exhaust ports. When green flares arced across the field, Franz flashed a half-salute to his crew chief and taxied away. His two young wingmen and the others followed him into the skies. Franz had not shot down a plane since encountering the wounded B-17 over Bremen on December 20th. Since that encounter, Franz's priorities had changed. He no longer strove for victories.
Now his mission was to get his boys home. With the arrival of 1944, the benchmark for the Knight's Cross had been raised to Magic 40. Franz couldn't care less. 20 minutes later, 40 miles southwest of Graz. From his perch at 29,000 feet, Franz and his squadron mates circled. Franz smiled through his oxygen mask. Some 10,000 feet beneath him flew 35 B-24 Liberators without fighter escort. The B-24s looked like mustardy brown tees against the thick winter clouds. Several miles behind the bomber formation, Franz saw a second batch of B-24s that looked to be even fewer in number. Checking his wingtips, Franz told his rookies to tighten up. Melman flew on his left wing and Zontak on his right. The old days of staggered formations were gone. Now, with so many rookies in the ranks, the new German formation was to fly side by side, so the flight leader could keep an eye on his wingmen. The B-24s kept motoring northward, their gunners undoubtedly watching the 109s, waiting for them to attack. His heart pounding, Franz scanned the skies for their escort fighters. He saw none. This never happened over Germany. Franz was accustomed to raids of 500 bombers, and had heard that the 8th Air Force was now sending 1,000 bomber raids since February 20th, a milestone the Americans called Big Week. What Franz saw below him seemed too good to be true.
"Keep your eyes peeled for escorts,"
Franz's group leader snapped over the radio. The group leader was talking to him.
"Yes, sir,"
Franz replied. Franz's squadron was on high patrol, and their job was to watch for escort fighters and cover the other squadrons